We're back. After an exciting first season, Top Tech Voices returns with fresh perspectives, deeper conversations, and even more inspiring voices from across the industry. This season, we're diving into how technology actually serves people, because innovation has the greatest value when it improves lives, protects what matters, and solves real human challenges, right? Whether you're tuning in from your desk, lab, or on the go, we're bringing you thought-provoking insights, expert interviews, and behind-the-scenes stories that matter. So let's get into the latest season of discovery, dialogue, and inspiration. Ever wondered why you do the things you do, even though you know you shouldn't? If you've ever been curious about why we make the choices that we do, how our brains can be reshaped by the world around us, or whether AI is changing the very way we think, today's conversation is for you. I'm joined by a neuroscientist who's going to unpack how the brain makes decisions, how technology is rewiring our minds, and what we can actually do to stay sharp in an age where it feels like technology is about to outsmart us. He's an author and broadcaster known for breaking down complex brain science into accessible insights. It's my pleasure to be joined by Dr. Jack Lewis. So I heard you were on Celebrity Big Brother. We're very lucky to have you.
Thank you very much. Yes, I met Rylan. He plays it daft. He's very, very bright, that man.
I'm sure. And I wanted to open with something broad. I love what you talk about when you articulate the bias of the human brain. And I think you put it so succinctly when you explained why there's so many 6-foot-tall CEOs.
Yeah, that's right. So we are very biased towards physical appearance. And it's because of evolutionarily, it used to be good if the leader of your band, your troop, your society was a physically large person, because it could defend you against wild animals and other bands and tribes who might be aggressive towards you. But, you know, when it comes to major corporate companies, your physical stature is not really important. It's how well you lead in other regards that is the most important. Yet there's a disproportionately large number of CEOs of US companies who are over 6 foot tall. And it's way more than you would get if we didn't have this bias.
We are more likely to trust someone who looks like they can lead.
Correct. If they look like a good leader, irrespective really of what's on their CV compared to other people, they'll be that little bit more likely to get the job, which is why they're so disproportionately highly represented.
So you're doing some fascinating research and you're all over the telly. How did you get into it?
Yeah, I distinctly remember announcing to my PhD colleagues when I was studying at University College London that I had an ambition to be a TV presenter, and they all laughed at me. And they're like, how are you going to do that? Like, oh yeah, all right then. Great, I'll look forward to seeing you. But as it happened, I signed up to, it was called Production Base, I think. It was a subscription service where you could hear about jobs in television. It was mainly aimed at directors and cameramen and, you know, people who produce it. And I was really frustrated for the whole first month. There were only really TV presenter jobs advertised, like fluent Chinese speaking presenter for a game show and stuff that was completely irrelevant. And then it was like BBC series. We're looking for 3 psychology or neuroscientists. And I was like amazed that I even knew what neuroscientists were to present 21-hour show, secretly filmed psychology experiments on the streets of London, recreating some of the best psychology experiments. And it involved going out onto Westminster Bridge. And it was all about obedience to uniform. And I showed that when I was wearing normal clothing, people wouldn't do as I asked them to. But when I wore what it was actually a prison officer's outfit, when I looked much more formal, then members of the public would, just be happy to follow my instruction.
And here you are. The rest is history. What I'm hearing is that it started with a decision. That's something you wanted to do. And I love your work on decisions. I'd love to get into it. You talk and research a lot about how and why we make decisions. And I was reading that you have a theory that our body makes the decision before we realize it. I'd love to hear a bit about that.
Yeah. So gut feeling. We often experience decision making as it was made on gut feeling. And that's kind of shorthand for the fact that the neural circuitry that we use to make decisions, we don't actually have any conscious access to it. So that circuitry makes the decision. It sometimes sends messages down into the body. So some people literally feel it in their gut. Other people just, you know, it's not in a part of their body. They're just, they know that it's an unconscious decision that suddenly has popped into their head. And then we rationalize it retrospectively. So that we know this is true thanks to EEG, electroencephalography. And those experiments are really good at detecting not so much where the signal's coming from inside the brain, but the timing it's excellent at detecting. And it was very clear that the brain area from which the decisions come from has made the decision several seconds before we actually have conscious awareness that we've reached a decision. So that is the proof that's always given, you know, by neuroscientists like me, that the decision is made on an unconscious basis and we find out about it later.
If we start to understand how and why people make decisions, can we use those insights in our businesses to help people make the decisions that we want them to?
I like the way you put that. Yes, you can manipulate people.
Yeah. Well, no. I was just wondering.
No. It's a good, and I often, you know, state that when I do my motivational speaking gigs, I often put it in not dissimilar terms, because the word manipulation is horrible. But I think we can all agree that whether it's at home or at work, we would be grateful if we were armed with some tricks and tips on how to get people to reach the decision that we want them to make, right? How to be more influential is a nicer way of putting it. And one thing that I always take and sort of, you know, share as widely as possible is from the neuroeconomic literature, where you stick people in an MRI scanner, magnetic resonance imaging scanner, to see what parts of the brain are more or less active under various circumstances. And the power of surprise is incredibly useful when it comes to getting an exaggerated response in the reward pathway. So the brain area in question is called the nucleus accumbens. And the nucleus accumbens is a part of the reward pathway which can predict the likely future reward that will result from choosing option A over B or C, right? And whichever of those options produces the strongest signal in the nucleus accumbens is the one we'll choose, all other things being equal. And the thing about surprise, so if someone were to win £100, but under circumstances where they knew it was coming, let's say they worked a shift in a bar, and then the moment the money is handed over to them in an envelope, you'd get a slight bump of activity in the reward pathway, which is commensurate with feeling satisfied that you've got your money. But if that same value of money, that same 100 quid, came under circumstances that were unexpected, say someone just left you 100 quid tip when you were working that shift in a bar, then it causes a much larger signal, not double, not treble, but more like sort of quadruple the strength response in this part of the reward pathway than the same reward, but under circumstances where it's expected. And the reason is that the brain is essentially a device which tries to work out how the world works. And in order to get better and better at that, it's trying to minimize surprise. So whenever something surprising happens, it needs to broadcast an error message to the whole rest of the brain so that we can learn what was different about today. You know, was I wearing a different outfit? Where did this tip come from? Was I particularly charming with that customer? Because you want to update your neurology to make it more likely that you can put yourself in front of those rewards in the future. So when it comes to getting people to reach the decision you want them to make, it always boils down to if you can deliver something that's, let's say, a benefit of the option you want people to choose under circumstances where it comes as an unexpected surprise, you make a disproportionately large impact on the very brain area that makes that decision. So I often describe it as do a Columbo on them. If you've got a feature in your product that is absolutely brilliant, do not lead with that in the negotiation. Talk about all the other wonderful things about your product. And then just when everyone in the room thinks they've heard it all, even you're getting up to move out the door, turn around and go, just one more thing. and then tell them about that unique, incredible thing. It just causes a much bigger response in the reward pathway, which is the part of the brain we make decisions with, and it will stay with that person and make them much more likely to go with the option you want them to take.
I'm surprised that surprise is so important when it comes to making decisions, but it sounds like positive surprising, because if it kind of stresses out your neurology, it would be the same the other way around, right? If it was like you don't want to negatively surprise someone.
You make a really good point though, because this is why this is where the phrase once bitten, twice shy comes from. So you can do the same thing with an expected loss of 100 quid compared to an unexpected loss of £100, and you get the same thing. Exactly to your point, but in the opposite direction. You get a suppression of activity in the reward pathway if it's expected, and a much more profound suppression if there's an unexpected loss of the same unitary value. So the reward pathway will just flatline for a few seconds, again, broadcasting to the brain, the rest of the brain, something awful's happened, I've made a huge loss, really don't want that to happen again. It triggers sort of negative emotions. And the size of the reduction to an unexpected loss in the reward pathway is much more profound than the size of the uptick in activity in response to an unexpected win. So again, this is a way you can get people to reach the decisions that you want them to make. If you can show that your product, your idea mitigates against the kind of disasters that people have experienced in the past, and you can point out why going with your idea or your product will protect them from that horrible experience they had in the past, that can also be really, really influential in pushing their decision in the direction you want them to go.
The balance of saving them from risk is almost as important as delighting them.
Precisely so.
Interesting. What about uncertainty and anxiety when it comes to decision making?
Wow, you've done your research. Yeah, so that's the other side. So if the reward pathway, and you know, you could say the increase in activity, but I always think of it as a balanced scales. So if on the one side of the scale, you've got how heavily the advantages weigh, and then on the other side, it's the how heavily the disadvantages weigh. So when I said, if the nucleus accumbens has a strong signal, stronger than all the others, a stronger signal to option A over B or C, all other things being equal, I was alluding to the fact that if the other things aren't equal, like for example, cost, the thing that you really, really like might be associated with a very, very high cost, and that causes that lowers the likelihood that you'll go for that option over the others. And so, yeah, the anterior insula is a part of the brain where if you, between the frontal lobe and the temporal lobe, there's the deep valley, and if you pull those two parts of the brain apart, right down in the valley, in the bottom of the valley, is an area called the anterior insula. Now, that's involved in generating feelings of disgust or unease or anxiety. So generally speaking, when there's a certain amount of uncertainty associated with a particular option, more uncertainty over, let's say, option A over B or C, then that signal that's generated in the anterior insula will make you less likely to go for that, even if the predicted reward is really high. And then there's another part of the brain called the anterior cingulate, and that's more to do with sort of signals that are inconsistent. So it's less uncertainty, more inconsistencies. So if, for example, from some sources you hear reviews that this product's excellent, but from others you hear they're not so good, I guess it does create uncertainty in the sense that you're not sure which of the reviews to believe. But when it doesn't quite add up, the anterior cingulate, which is where the two frontal lobes meet in the center, that's also a signal that makes you less likely to go for that particular option if the signal's strong. And it's more about, hang on, something here doesn't quite add up, as in I can't quite trust the evidence that I'm being presented here. So again, that'll lead someone to be less likely to go with that. So from the perspective of the individual, trying to get people to make the decisions you want them to make, it's all about being consistent in your messaging and sending out messages that reduce a person's anxiety in the sense of uncertainty over whether or not the proffered kind of benefits will be delivered.
Mm. Yeah, I guess when you were talking about surprise, I also thought of kind of like offering something new as another way of saying surprise. But then I suppose with the addition of what you just said, in a calming way, almost. What I was surprised about in your research was how much you mentioned disgust. I don't feel like that's an emotion that gets as much PR as the other ones.
Yeah.
Why is that important?
So Disgust, again, I always think as a neuroscientist, I'm sort of almost conditioned by my reading. And also, by the way, neuroscience talks about the brain from the perspective of comparing the human primate brain to non-human primates' brains, to dog brains, to cat brains, to rat brains, to mouse brains. And you can see a sort of, if you reverse up that hierarchy, the capabilities of those various creatures become more and more complex and diverse and capable of doing greater things. And so it's very much about where is the benefit of feeling a sense of revulsion in response to certain stimuli. So where it comes from originally is that if you see like a horrible, you open a bag and there's an old lunchbox in there and it's all rotten food and that like stomach turning revulsion, it protects you from harm. It keeps you away from that thing, where if you brought it too close and were to put it in your mouth, for example, then it could make you very, very sick. But the interesting thing about us humans, just going back to that sort of more complex than other mammal thing, is that just by seeing a look of revulsion on someone else's face, we don't have to get close enough. We don't even need to see what it was that created that facial expression of disgust. We will instantly empathize with that person's disgust and stay away from whatever it is that they're looking at. So disgust is a very simple signal creating an aversion, which makes us want to move away from whatever stimulus it is. On the other hand, when we see delight, which is, you know, someone's smiling, happy face, a surprising wonder, that happiness that they feel makes us curious about what it is that they have just experienced, then we want a little bit of that too, you know? So these emotions are ways that we can almost like wordlessly share information with other humans.
Mm-hmm. Well, that leads me on nicely, because it's really important that we read other people's faces, right? And are you worried about the next generation's capability to read signals from other people in the age of AI and social media overwhelm?
What a great question. I very much am. The outer surface of the human brain, the gray matter, so to speak, is where all of the synapses are, the interfaces between the different neurons. 86 billion neurons in the human brain, 86 billion glial cells, which support those wire-like cells, enable them to do all the computations that are responsible for everything we're capable of doing. And there's a very large territory dedicated to producing empathy in response to unconsciously detected body language cues. It could be someone, a saccade, someone, you know, looking away and looking back again so quickly that you can't really detect it consciously, yet your brain does clock it. A fleeting facial expression. It could be a crinkle around the eyes. It could be, you know, the lips sort of crease downwards suddenly. These things are so subtle. And the only way we get good at detecting them in order to trigger feelings that guide us as to how best to interact with that person on the basis of how we can tell their feeling deep down, so not the words they're saying, but what they're feeling underneath those words, they need practice, they need training. We need to be looking at faces in order to keep those empathy circuits primed and responsive. Now, the problem is, if people spend their whole lives looking down at screens, even when they're physically with other people, and we've all been there, right? Bars, restaurants, commuting, trains and buses, like people are just head down the whole time. Neural circuits are use it or lose it. And if we want to talk about the drivers of London's famous black cabs, which prove this, then I'm very happy to go there later. But in the meantime, take my word for it, it's use it or lose it. If you don't stimulate those brain pathways by looking at people's faces when you're interacting with them, you lose those capabilities, you lose the empathy. And if you think about it, that's bad for the individual. It's absolutely terrible for society.
Yeah, I wonder if there's a way that, like, if we get off our phones, is there a way we can practice sharpening those muscles?
Absolutely. It's really simple. All it is that phones, there's nothing good or bad about smartphones. It's how we use them. And they are so seductive. They make us put so much of our time each day into them that it displaces time away from activities that we could get more benefit from. So it's really simple. Look for opportunities to not look at your phone. Regularly think to myself, to yourself, to oneself, how much is continually checking my email actually helping me? How much is two or three times an hour checking my Instagram posts, my Facebook posts, my, you know, TikTok videos, whatever? You have to stop, come up for air and think, is this really delivering benefit? Because it's a difference between an impulse to do something, and impulsive behavior is that felt good, I want more of it, and compulsion, where you do it repeatedly, irrespective of whether it gives you pleasure or not. And this is actually a hallmark of addiction. It's the same thing with drugs. Some people do drugs because, recreational drugs I'm talking about, because they have an impulsive desire to, ooh, that was really fun last time, I want to do it again. But then when it gets to the level of compulsion, and so let's say take the example of opiates, you can give someone a drug called naltrexone, which blocks all opiate receptors, and they will continue to take heroin anyway, which proves they cannot get any hedonic pleasure from it. They are doing it because they have a compulsion to do it. And so park recreational drugs. It's the same with digital inputs. Do I do this because it gives me pleasure, or do I do this because I'm just so habitually trained to do it that it's actually not in my best interest? It's only in the best interest of the tech companies. And I borrow a little bit of inspiration from a really cool study that was done and published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, trying to tackle obesity. And they trained teenagers, adolescents, on all of the horrible, nasty things that multinational companies do to try and target young people with fast foods and crisps and fizzy drinks and stuff from a super, super young age, to train them up to get them eating and drinking more, right? To normalize the consumption of lots and lots of calories. But when educated, like, you get a bunch of adolescents and you teach them this is what those multinational companies are doing, and then you monitor them the next day when they're at the buffet, they will choose healthier options because they're so, you can almost like harness that natural adolescent outrage, and they just disgusted once they find out the truth of the matter, and they just really rail against it, and they suddenly find a motivation to eat the healthy food, not the crap. Right? So you could do the same thing with tech. You could tell these kids who are looking at their screens too much, and you could help them get off their screens at least half the time, at least hopefully like 3/4 of the hours of the day they're not on screens. 25% is still a lot, right? Yeah. 25% of 16 hours is, you know, if you're asleep for 8 hours, 25%, 4 hours of screen time is a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But people, teens are consuming more than that. Mm-hmm. And it's, anyway, so I'm hoping that by explaining that they're not evil, these tech companies, it's just A-B testing, and it's an attention economy. So it's all about what keeps people on these things for longer. That's all they care about, because that's what generates ad revenues. By realizing that it's essentially creating super addictive technologies and they don't care, they just want to keep the profits flowing, it could harness a little bit of outrage that would lead to healthy outcomes. I don't know. It's a hypothesis that could be tested.
That's interesting. I suppose it's like rewiring your neural pathways for resistance, which I haven't heard as a theory before. But I was really interested in something you said, which was just the mere fact of seeing your phone in the corner of your eye can distract you from working. And I found that yesterday I was doing something, my phone happened to be downstairs, and I just got so much more done. You know, we are, and I'd love to hear about that and how that relates to neuroplasticity, if we can change our behavior for better or worse.
Yeah, so that kind of goes back to, I came on halfway through a comedy show called The Ranganation to talk about the impact of smartphones on the brain. And at that time, there were clues, early clues, that it might affect our attention. We struggle to focus our attention for long periods of time. Memory, we might be struggling to remember stuff we read on screens because we don't process it very deeply. Empathy, we've already talked about. But this was a much more recent one. When I went back to the literature last year, all of the other early clues had been corroborated with much more evidence. But this idea of the mere presence of your smartphone nearby is enough to derail your cognitive faculties when you're doing something relatively complex. And so we're all aware that, like, if you allow your phone to distract you by allowing the notifications to bleep, then that can disrupt your attention, and then it takes a while to get back to what you were doing, you know? We're all familiar with that. But this series of papers was all about how the mere presence of a smartphone can make you make more errors, produce work to a less high standard, and it takes longer to get things done. And that's even with it switched off, but within your peripheral vision. was enough to cause those problems.
I guess the kind of dichotomy of it is that these devices offer the cell that we're actually getting more done. And sometimes I feel like I'm being more productive by multitasking, but that's not quite right, is it?
Multitasking. There's no such thing. Now, I'll caveat that with saying it's fine to walk along the road whilst having a phone conversation, or whilst, you know, ideally when you're away from the side of the road, but you can send the text message whilst you're walking. But that's because the brain circuitry involved in coordinating your movements and the brain circuitry involved in creating a DM or a text message are different. They're not overlapping. But if you're doing cognitive tasks simultaneously and it feels like you're multitasking, what you're actually doing is switching from one task to the other and then back again. And it always comes at a switch cost. It always takes a few seconds for you to be able to get back where you were with the original task, having pulled your attention away and come back again. So yeah, this idea of multitasking is false, demonstrably untrue. And you're right, it is a bit of a dichotomy that on the one hand, it's undeniable. Technology does help us get more done. We've got the whole of mankind's knowledge at our fingertips, but it's about choosing when you pick up that phone and choosing when you put it down again. Or indeed, media multitasking is a thing. You're not doing it simultaneously, but you're still cycling your attention from, say, so heavy media multitaskers compared to low media multitaskers. Heavy media multitaskers are people who will never just watch television. They'll also have a laptop out on their lap. They'll periodically look at their smartphone for social media updates or whatever. So they're surfing the web, they're watching telly, and they're doing some kind of correspondence on their phone. And these people will typically cycle their attention between the different screens once every 15 seconds. And there is a lot of research showing that if you compare those kind of people to low media multitaskers who tend to do one thing at a time. They'll either be watching telly, or they're surfing the internet on the laptop, or they're on their phone, but they're not constantly trying to cycle. With a really simple visual task whereby there's like a pair of oriented lines, and then they disappear and they come back again, and one of them has changed position or it hasn't, right? This was the first study that came out in 2009. And you can then add distractors, extra oriented lines in the background. It's just such a visual task. Did it change or not? Heavy media multitaskers could handle two distractors in addition to the two targets. But then compared to the low media multitaskers, who were fine even when there were four or six or eight, the heavy media multitaskers started getting a decline in performance after four, and then even more so after six. So this was really early evidence that heavy media multitaskers were perhaps training their brain through neuroplasticity, which you alluded to but I didn't get onto, to end up with an outcome that is not ideal for those individuals. It seems that they struggle to block out the distractions that are extraneous to the task they're trying to do. Now, 16 years has passed since that early research, and it transpires. Lots more research has been done comparing heavy media multitaskers to low media multitaskers, and it reduces attention. Sustained attention. People struggle to focus their attention for long periods of time. Long-term memory is reduced. Working memory is reduced, which is the ability to retain information for just long enough to complete a simple task. So like if I told you my number was 0208-792-3491, you can hold that in your working memory for long enough to dial it, possibly, mm-hmm. right? Heavy media multitaskers can't. They've got a much narrower working memory than low media multitaskers. Problem solving, fluid problem solving, as in it's the fluid intelligence is the side of things where you solve a problem that you've never solved before. Crystalline intelligence is where you can just pull out your old tricks and techniques that you've used to solve problems before. So it's about novel problem solving is reduced in heavy media multitaskers. And then the last three things, and I will get to the end of the list, but it's quite a decrement. They have more social anxiety and they have a higher incidence of neuroticism. So, you know, there's a lot of reasons to not engage in heavier multitasking, meaning, you know, the message is just do one thing at a time.
It's hard in this modern world, though. And I do really want to get to the technological solutions and be positive, but I can't get there without asking about AI. You know, we're in this fourth industrial revolution. It's a technology that's comparable to electricity. And you've spoken about Gen AI brain. It's you know, has been contested. It is fairly new research. And I, in lots of ways, you know, you'll know, perhaps we don't know for sure yet, but I'd love to know what your thinking is.
So, yeah, Gen Brain, there's an AI in brain. I had to. I capitalized the AI. It's as yet unproven. So it's like there were early clues 6, 7, 8 years ago that it's always about excessive smartphone use, right? In moderation, as with everything, in moderation, it's fine. It's no big deal. It's like technology's great, go for it. But it's all about excessive use, over-reliance. In the context of generative AI, it's about cognitive offloading even the critical thinking, you know? So allowing generative AI to do all of the legwork, that's the problem. Using Gen AI a little bit, experimenting with it, using it in ways where you're a partner to it, not a slave to the outcomes. The problem with Gen AI is it's having a huge impact on the workplace, right? I think that's undeniable. The first thing, there are so many different Gen AI tools, right? And different use cases for them that you can't make too many generalizations. But it definitely gets things done faster. I think we can all agree with that. Quick prompt, hopefully well-structured using good prompt engineering, and you'll get an output incredibly quickly. But that means that the human worker's job becomes to go through it and troubleshoot and make sure that it's all accurate because of the all-famous AI hallucinations. Now, I feel silly telling an AI expert about this, but, you know, for the sake of the conversation, if there's one and only one factually correct answer to a question, generative AI will get it wrong 1 in 3 times, even the latest models.
But that's right now. I mean, by the time the podcast comes out, it might have changed.
Well, that's true, but AI hallucination is inevitable because it's not retrieving information, it's generating it. And if you generate it on the basis of stats, what's the most likely next token? By definition, you could look at it probabilistically. It's not always going to get it right. You can minimize the error, but the error will still be there. So at the moment, it's 1 in 3. But even if it goes down to 1 in 10, the trouble is, if you're an expert in something and you say, let's say neuroscience, give me 10 bullet points of the impact of technology on the brain. And I know that literature inside and out. And you'll see at the moment, the 3 AI hallucinated facts are so well hidden amongst the 7 that you know to be true. The trouble with Gen AI is that the erroneous parts of it are completely plausible and they're hiding, and you really have to dig it out. If you're not an expert in it and you're just like, wow, that's so coherent and beautifully put. Like there's a real tendency in the early Gen AI research to forego your own best judgment because just the way the generative AI algorithm put it, it was just so neat and tidy and clean and persuasive that it must be true. And so even though you've got a hunch that, hang on, I'm sure that's wrong. And then I've been through this. I go, please, Gen AI tool, many are available. Where did you get that from? Could you find me the reference? And because it's a neuroscience paper, it'll take me half an hour to read this paper, not only to find out that the piece of evidence that was cited isn't in there, but that reference has absolutely nothing to do with the subject matter in question, or that the reference is completely made up. And so my fear is, and it's not my fear, it's the fear of researchers in the field, and I've read their work, is this kind of has a massive head-on collision with cognitive miserliness. Humans are lazy. And it's pragmatic to, you know, not expend more energy than you need to get something done. But under circumstances where Gen AI is producing very rapidly reams and reams of output, and you know that there's errors in there, but it's a lot of work, and you could just call it quits, you know, bang it out in an email or a press release or whatever and go to the pub or go back to see your family or whatever, cognitive miserliness says that people will take the shortcut, and increasingly, well, A, they might not have an awareness that you need to second guess everything that Gen AI outputs. And then secondarily, even if you do know, your inherent laziness means that sometimes you'll cut corners and just hope for the best. I think the main problem with this is that you won't give those brain areas responsible for supporting your critical thinking enough exercise to maintain their capability. And the problem with losing your capacity to do critical thinking is that it's only with critical thinking skills that you can detect when you're being manipulated. And so my fear is that if everyone gets Gen AI to do all the hard work and they never do it the long way themselves, then it leaves individuals and therefore societies at large even more vulnerable to manipulation than we already are. Like, we will just unquestioningly accept the recommendations and guidance and outputs of our Gen AI algorithms, and it becomes a bit of a race to the bottom. So long as I always recommend people, so by all means avail yourself of the time-saving aspects of Gen AI, but even if it's perfect, do it the long way 1 in 3 times to maintain your cognitive capabilities.
I've never thought about it this way before, but you know, we opened and I asked you, why are so many CEOs 6 foot? Because people trust them more to be leaders. I suppose you could compare it to, why do people trust AI when it spits out gobbledygook? Because it's presented so well and it's given to us by a machine that we inherently think is more trustworthy than us, and is actually trained on the data sets of millions of humans. So, you know, you could argue is collective human intelligence. But I've never kind of thought about that relationship before, about the way it's presented and why we feel that way. I'm glad you mentioned critical thinking. I often compare AI to like a puppy dog that's just trying to please you. You know, it's just like generating what it thinks that you want. And I think critical thinking is the most important skill to cultivate in the age of AI. But I've heard you say that you think AI is actually going to be the death of people's critical thinking. So how can we sharpen it? And tell me a bit more about that.
It's interesting when you talk about the puppy dog just wanting to please you. There's an interesting article in the New Yorker at the moment about sycophantic LLMs and why it's a problem, where it's like, it's all about how you tune up the generative AI algorithms. And when you want people to use them more, we talked about the attention economy with social media, but when you want people, more and more people to use more and more often your tools, I guess they found that it helps if you're always supportive and you're always nice. But actually, I think about our friendships, the ones that we value the most, where when we have an absolutely ludicrous idea, not just I want to be a TV presenter, but like I want to be an astronaut, even though I'm rubbish at science. Or I often say to, you know, when I do kind of go into schools to talk about careers, and so many boys want to be footballers and so many girls want to be famous. Like, that's literally what 13, 14, 15 year olds say. I've heard it many, many times. It's like you're always grateful when people kind of just give you a reality check when what you're aiming for is very unlikely to come to fruition. And the problem with Gen AI being sycophantic is, you know, it's like, oh, I want to create a jetpack so that I can, you know, fly myself across the Atlantic. Well, if it comes back to you, yeah, what a great idea, this is how you do it, that's not helpful, that's not useful. Mm-hmm. And so I think it would be wise for people to think about, to what degree is this just sort of blowing smoke up my proverbial just to make me feel good about myself, rather than it's actually useful feedback. And coming back to critical thinking, there are ways of using generative AI that can really help you become better at critical thinking. But you need to be a little bit more limited in how you permit yourself to use it. So a paper that came out last month did a direct comparison. It's a simple sort of humanities question. It was conducted in a multiplicity of different countries. And it was like, is democracy good or bad? Or, you know, the positives and negatives of democracy discussed. And under one set of circumstances, there was no AI assistance at all. It was just the person using their general knowledge and their, you know, ability to construct arguments. Under another circumstance, it was using AI, but in an unconstrained fashion. And then in another set of circumstances, it was using structured prompting. So you're somewhat limited in how you can use it, in the sense of, you don't just say, I want you to write me a convincing argument evaluating the positives and negatives of democracy, and then bang, you know, just do it all for me. It was, here's the task, help me explore some possible hypotheses. And then you as the human go in and you curate them, you use your judgment to work out which hypotheses are strong, which hypotheses are weak. And so you go in and troubleshoot and use your judgment. And then it might be, okay, so on the basis of what you've written, I'm going to write. So you use it as inspiration, but you then go on to write it yourself. And then you write an argument, and then you put that into the Gen AI algorithm and you say, stress test this for me. Do a SWOT analysis on this, few paragraphs I wrote. And so you're using the generative AI as, again, keyword thing is constructively critical partner, to help you do a better version of what you just did, as opposed to just getting Gen AI to do it. That's another great use case for generative AI, mm-hmm. where it might even accelerate your ability to develop your critical thinking.
And I also think, you know, AI is a tool. It's not one thing right now, but it's very easy to say, oh, like AI is ruining our brain. But you just gave us some great examples of how it might be able to use, might be able to enhance our thinking, which leads me nicely to the technological solutions, because I could get deep in the weeds about AI personalities for like another hour. But I'd like to know, what tech can we use to save our brains from this modern world that we're not quite evolved to handle? You know, we're on our phone too much, and I would like to claim back my time, really, and my autonomy. And are there any pieces of tech that can help me get there?
Absolutely. I'm a big fan of virtual reality. Mm-hmm. And I know it sounds odd because you're literally putting essentially a smartphone screen right over someone's eyes. But in a world where people struggle to pay attention, if you stick a virtual reality headset on them, it's effectively a blindfold, and you have complete control over what they're looking at. Okay, you can't control exactly what direction they're looking in, but you can push the pixels in their environment and you can nudge them in potentially benevolent directions. Mm-hmm. And they can't pick up their phone because you can't see what's on your smartphone screen very well. And also, it doesn't occur to people. When people put on a VR headset, I did a master's in virtual reality 2019 to 2022. And so off the back of that, I built a virtual reality team building experience for the World Economic Forum. I then worked for a company who developed surgical training using haptic feedback, robotic pens, which could simulate the feeling of doing eye surgery for cataract surgery. So VR headset, robotic arms to simulate the feeling of grabbing the eyeball with forceps and making an incision with a variety of different scalpels. Finally landed on an EdTech solution to making learning GCSE more maths. So you make pizzas in a restaurant at the end of the universe. It's the game's called Pizza Maths. And I've taken it into a variety of different schools all over the southeast of England. And like, kids love learning by doing, and they love to sort of run a business in the sense of like serve customers. The first thing they have to do is to work out the correct proportion of ingredients for any given recipe. Then they have to do some calculations with regard to setting the oven at the right temperature to activate the Martian or the Venusian sourdough. And then they have to slice it with the correct angles for the very picky customers who want it sliced in a variety of unusual ways. So like, the teachers love it because anything that gets kids a bit more interested in maths is good for them if they're the head of maths. It's not a replacement to teachers. It's more like if certain kids are struggling with a certain aspect of sort of fundamental maths, just give them a headset to take away over the weekend and then they come back on Monday. Like, the one thing that my CTO and I really push for is to make it a fun game to play, irrespective of whether you're interested in getting better at maths, right? So it's game first, maths secondarily. I absolutely love VR, and just to kind of clarify, I absolutely hate AR. I hate augmented reality.
Why?
I hate the idea of people walking around with Meta Ray-Ban glasses, because those cameras pointing out are a privacy nightmare. If everyone wanders around, it's not just the CCTV on the walls. It's like any environment you're in with other humans wearing these glasses, they are recording you. There was an amazing research article. No, it wasn't. It was just an article about some kid, master's student at MIT, wired up his glasses to an AI algorithm that could take photos of people, search the internet, pull up information about them, and he'd start conversations with them. Oh, are you Dorothy Smith? Yeah, I remember you. Because you teach history at this college, and you know, he did it under the auspices of raising awareness of how much augmented reality glasses could be used for ill, right? So the reason that I make this huge, a lot of people like XR, you know, augmented and virtual reality and or mixed reality. I don't want to mix them up because I think virtual reality is a force for good, because the user chooses, am I in or am I out of the real world? Whereas augmented reality, blending the two, it lends itself to too many possibilities of warping people's perspective of reality even more so than smartphones do already.
Yeah, I think we're lucky in that respect, living in the UK with the laws around augmented reality compared to some other countries. But obviously you're a neuroscientist, but I feel like for the average person, it's not that far away from psychology. And I really liked what you touched upon about the intersection of virtual reality, psychology and neuroscience to help people understand others' perspectives. Do you think it's a useful tool for that?
Oh my God, it is. I read an amazing book by one of the early pioneers of virtual reality, and he's quoted dozens of times of, you know, cool ways of describing VR. But one of them is, it's an empathy machine. You know, this is Jaron Lanier, such an amazing thinker. And, you know, even when back in the 80s, when VR wasn't really up to much, he was already dreaming of all of the possible use cases. And one of the ones that I love is that it can have a prejudice reducing impact on people. So there's a psychological experimental technique called implicit association test. And so you have the testees pressing one of two different buttons, right? The participants in the experiment will either press one button to mean good, another button to mean bad, but then the first button can mean white and the second button can mean black. So you have to sort of very rapidly respond to images that are flashed up on screen. And so first you're going good, bad, bad, good, good, bad, bad, good. And then you switch it and then you have to answer black, white, white, black, white, according to the image that comes up. And so the implicit association test can reveal implicit racial biases by making it incurring a slight delay when the button white and the it is not the same button as the button for responding good. So when the when you switch, so under circumstances where button A is how you respond to white and good, and button Z is responding to black and bad, the responses are accelerated compared to when you switch the contingency and white is compared with bad and black is compared with good. It's a very slight millisecond delay, like, you know, 10 milliseconds slower when there's a bit of a cognitive kind of logjam between the two concepts in that person's head. But then you put on a VR headset where they experience what it's like. So these are white people usually, and they inhabit, they can see in a mirror that they're a black person. And they spend some time in that environment wearing a black person's body, so feeling black. And then there's another way of the original one was where you can make them take ownership of a rubber hand, where that hand in question is brown skin tone. And by, you know, a bit of kind of multisensory illusion, you take ownership of that brown hand. When you go in and do the implicit association test again, that delay is reduced significantly. And so that's taken to mean that that intrinsic prejudice against people who are of different skin tone to yourself is reduced by virtue of having embodied their body. Mm. The same thing has worked for, you know, sexism and also obesity prejudice. And so it seems like VR can be used to inhabit the bodies of other people and thereby be more tolerant of them, having spent a few minutes experiencing life looking different to how you look.
The power of virtual reality to understand each other more as a human species, I mean, sounds like a utopian dream, but it also sounds really powerful. And you have covered a lot of ground. But what I wanted to end on was something interesting I saw in your research, which was you talk a bit about ancient wisdom, and you touched on it here in our discussion as well, only doing one thing at a time, which was kind of alluding to the idea of presence. You know, we're in this age of AI and we all want to get loads done. But do you think there's an argument for we're actually at the time to look to the wisdom of our ancestors?
Hobbies are really important. And I know it sounds odd, but hobbies often involve using the hands, you know, dexterous movements. And, you know, whether it's holding a paintbrush in order to get the, I mean, I'm not an artist myself, but my wife absolutely loves it. And she gets so much out of painting or drawing. And I do a bit of stone carving because I just, the parts of the brain dedicated to the sense of touch and moving the hands, like they're vastly larger than the parts of the brain involved in detecting touch or indeed moving other body parts, right? We are a very manual species. And a lot of the things that we love doing that give us deep intrinsic reward, like there's no actual purpose for me doing my stone carving because my stone carvings are ugly. They're not very good. But the process of doing it, like the idea that the journey is the destination, it's deeply enjoyable because it involves focus, like especially with stone carving. If you chip a bit of stone off, it's never coming back again, right? So you have to be careful. And the thing about hobby is it's never ending. You can always get better and better. You can always do another and another thing. And I think it helps us go back to something a bit more primal than screen-based technologies.
You've been in the brain game for a while, it's fair to say. What has been your most surprising insights?
One thing that comes to mind is I've been doing motivational speaking for like 16 years now, and I've stood up in front of audiences from every imaginable industry, right? Most recently, plastic industry. Before that, the Ministry of Defence and the Crown Prosecution Service and teachers and people in the pharmaceutical industry. And the question I always start with, it's 4 a.m., you're wide awake, you can't get back to sleep. Hands up if you find this a familiar scenario. And without exception, at least 50% of the audience put their hand up. Maybe 75% in more recent times is quite typical. You know, like sometimes 65, sometimes 85, but the majority put their hand up. And the reason I start there is because sleep is so important for the brain. And when it's obviously very common, right? We all wake up in the middle of the night and worry and can't get back to sleep. And quite often what people choose to do, they don't realize they're actually incentivizing their unconscious brain to make it more likely for them to wake up in the middle of the night in the future because they'll do something vaguely pleasant, like, you know, have a look at social media or read a book or go and make a drink or listen to a podcast or something. That is exactly not what you want to do. What you should actually do is go downstairs and clean the oven. You need to do something mildly punishing because then that sends a message to your deep unconscious that if you wake me up in the middle of the night, something unpleasant will happen. And I know it sounds crazy, but when you go down through the sleep cycles, you go into deep sleep, up into REM sleep or dream sleep. You go down into deep sleep, up into REM sleep. It's after about two or three cycles that you come up into dream sleep. And it's a brain state that's very similar to being conscious. Like if you scan someone's brain when they're dreaming, it's almost, it's very, very similar to a fully conscious awake brain. So it's those moments where you run the risk of coming up into full wakefulness. And then when you do, you know, think your thoughts going round and round your head might prevent you from going back down again. So it's when you're in that sort of subliminal hypnopompic state where you're on the verge of coming up into consciousness that, if your brain knows that only horrors await out there, then you'll go straight back down into another bout of deep sleep. So, yeah, so many people are affected by it. So many do the wrong thing.
What was that word? Hypnopompic?
So hypnagogic state is the most creative state the human brain can be in, and that's when you're dipping into sleep for the first time. Hypnopompic is when you're in that subliminal state where you're coming out of sleep into full consciousness.
What's the evolutionary purpose of us getting into the most creative state possible just as we're about to go to sleep?
Oh, what a good question. I have no idea. I have no idea why.
Maybe it's that we have to get completely relaxed before we can truly come up with a good idea or something like that, like shut off other parts of our brains. But you would know more about that as an actual neuroscientist.
I've never really thought of that. Such a good thought. But I think what you said just then is probably it. It's a tension and then relax, tension and relax. When you're chipping away at the mind face, or the coal face of whatever problem you're trying to solve, you do need to step away from it. Yeah, that'll be it. You're disengaging the cognitive, so the neural pathways involved in consciously steering your thoughts here, there, and everywhere. Once you release it and let it go, then everything can just percolate in a more natural, fluid way. Yeah, no, this is great. I've never thought of it, but that is a fantastic point.
And if that theory was to ring true, I wonder if the power of meditation might be an alternative way to get there also.
So stress, the best thing you can do if you're stressed is to meditate. It's so powerful. Like there's a load of research done, I think it was 20 plus studies. It has a benefit to your physical health, your mental health and it improves cognitive performance. Mm-hmm. And so for those who don't do it, it's really good to know, because more research was done over the 10 years that followed. After just 8 weeks of 20 minutes a day mindfulness meditation, you increase your capacity to use mindfulness to reduce cortisol levels, stress levels in a physiologically measurable way. That's sick. Like, it's so rare to get neuroscience research that is that kind of clear cut in terms of what dose you need and how soon you get the mm-hmm. benefits. It's
incredible. No psychedelics, no tech, no, it's just you. So do you have any predictions for the future? Like, where do you see us going in the next 20 years when it comes to the health of our brains?
Whoa, that's a big question. So in 2045, what are we going to be doing with technology and neuroscience? Well, the first thing that comes to mind is kind of brain implant stuff, very much in its infancy right now. But there are some really exciting developments that happened recently. So one that comes to mind is this guy who lost the ability to speak. And so they implanted an electrode or an array of electrodes into the part of the motor cortex that controls lip-mouth movements, and also the premotor cortex, which sends messages to those other brain areas to kind of tell the different parts of the mouth and larynx what to do. And it's with the help of generative AI I think it was machine learning models, a different type of AI, which enabled that person through many, many repetitions to not just speak like a robot, he sounded like a robot when he first did it. But this paper actually showed the videos of him from 1 week to the next, to the next, to the next. And then they started allowing him to ask a question with a rising tone at the end, you know? So instead of him being, so what's the weather like? It was like, what's the weather like today? You know, he could put some kind of emotional prosody into his voice. And then the algorithm was trained on lots of recordings from when he did have a voice. And so more and more, it could interpret the signals that the neurons were sending and convert it on the fly into a voice which he recognized and his partner recognized as being like really his old voice. And it's that kind of thing, like giving a person back their voice, allowing them to communicate fluently, fluidly, naturally with their loved ones. That kind of stuff is going to start happening more and more.
Mm, thank you. That's a lovely positive note to end on. Hopefully we can look after our brains in the age of information overwhelm. Thank you so much for joining me.
Been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.